On September 29, 2005, John G. Roberts, Jr. was confirmed by the United States Senate as the 17th Chief Justice of the United States. At age 50 years, he became the youngest Chief Justice since John Marshall took the bench in 1801 at the age of 45. Born in Buffalo, New York, Justice Roberts grew up in Long Beach, Indiana. He attended Harvard University, where he majored in history and distinguished himself academically, graduating a year early with highest honors. Following graduation, Justice Roberts attended Harvard Law School, where he was the managing editor of the Harvard Law Review, graduating again with high honors. He was then hired as a law clerk for Judge Henry J. Friendly of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second District. At the end of the year, Mr. Roberts was hired as a clerk to then Associate Justice William H. Rehnquist of the Supreme Court, the man he eventually replaced as Chief Justice. When he finished his Supreme Court clerkship in 1981, he was hired by the Reagan administration, first as a special assistant to the U.S. Attorney General, and then as Associate Counsel to the President. Justice Roberts served as Principal Deputy Solicitor General from 1989 to 1993, and also worked in private practice. He was nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit by President Bush in January of 2003 and was sworn in on June 2, 2003. Chief Justice Roberts is currently a member of the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers, the American Law Institute, and the Edward Coke Appellate American Inn of Court. He and his wife Jane and their two children live in Maryland. Please welcome Chief Justice John G. Roberts to Brigham Young University.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, President Samuelson, for that generous introduction. I'm delighted to be here at BYU today, and I'm grateful to all of you who've made me feel so very welcome. Even on a serious occasion such as this, I think most people expect me to begin with a lawyer joke. But I no longer tell lawyer jokes, particularly to mixed gatherings such as this. It turns out the lawyers don't think they're very funny, and the non-lawyers don't think they're jokes. I'm aware that Utah has a long tradition of welcoming visitors. More than 150 years ago, the explorer John Fremont described how, after an arduous winter trek through the Rockies in 1853, he and his expedition team struggled to reach the pioneer settlement at Parowan, Utah. The settlers there opened their homes to Fremont's team and saved them from starvation. I've arrived fully fed on a fine fall day. Nevertheless, I can easily imagine from your gracious welcome the kindness and generosity that Fremont and his companions received. Last month, on September 11th, President and Mrs. Samuelson spoke at this forum. They announced the Year of the Constitution at BYU, and they challenged each incoming student to read at least one book on the Constitution. I applaud their inspirational talk, so much so that I would like to follow their example and assign more reading. As President Samuelson pointed out, the Constitution contains words that we live by. He's quite right that, for persons of faith, they are not the only words. But for all Americans, the actual words of the Constitution are vitally important. I would therefore like to suggest that you not only read about the Constitution, but that you read the Constitution itself. It is a short but powerful document. It is the most enduring written Constitution in history. One comparison is that in the 220 years since our Constitution was promulgated, the French have had 10 constitutions. The story is told of a visitor in Paris who went to a bookstore and asked for a copy of the Constitution. The proprietor replied that his store didn't carry periodicals. Now, our Constitution begins with a preamble, one of the most eloquent statements of determined and lofty purposes in human history. Quote, We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now, President Reagan often spoke of the groundbreaking import of the first three words, "We the people." Historian Gordon Wood has said that these words embody one of the most creative moments in the history of political thought. In their very first phrase, the framers announced that we the people, not a distant monarch, not a despotic emperor, not a self-appointed few, but we the people control America's destiny. The people created and empowered a new form of limited government with specific enumerated powers. The framers themselves, of course, recognized the significance of their opening phrase. One of the most effective objections raised by those who opposed ratification of the Constitution was that, as promulgated, it lacked a Bill of Rights. Alexander Hamilton responded to this objection in an essay known as Federalist No. 84 by pointing to the first three words of the Constitution. This is what he said. "Here is a better recognition of popular rights than volumes of those aphorisms which make the principal figure in several of our state bills of rights. The Constitution is itself, in every rational sense and to every useful purpose, a bill of rights." End quote. Now, the preamble sets forth what the framers expected of the central government they were creating. The framers, who were in a very real sense pioneers, crafted the Constitution to address inadequacies in the central government under the Articles of Confederation, but also to be responsive to the need to preserve the liberties they had so recently won in the War for Independence. The framers accomplished these competing objectives through an ingenious division of power, both between the federal and state governments and between the three branches of the federal government itself. Now, the framers, like Utah's first pioneers, did not proceed without guidance from others. Just as Brigham Young took counsel from the journals of early explorers, like Fremont, the framers found guidance from the writings of political theorists like Locke and Montesquieu. Like the settlers who came to Utah in 1847, the framers deserve enormous credit for transforming an academic conception to concrete form. Now, the great English historian Macaulay commented to an American that, quote, "Your Constitution is all sail and no anchor." Well, the anchor is in the structure of the Constitution itself, the separation of powers between branches that depend on each other if the ship of state is to sail. Now, the framers surely understood that dividing government power among legislative, executive, and judicial branches would be inefficient when compared to the autocratic rule of a king. Your former president here at BYU, Rex Lee, spoke to this subject some 25 years ago. He recounted how, as the dean of the BYU Law School, he had asked an historian to identify examples of monarchs under whose reign the people had prospered because of the efficiencies resulting from their absolute rule. The historian came up with Napoleon, Frederick the Great, Louis XIV, Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great. Dean Lee then asked the historian for examples of monarchs who had subjected their people to great suffering because the monarch enjoyed absolute unchecked power. The historian thought for a while and then responded, "Napoleon, Frederick the Great, Louis XIV, Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great." Now, the framers valued efficiency as we all do. They knew that they had to improve upon the efficiency of the central government under the Articles of Confederation if the new United States were to survive. But they had lived under tyranny, and they preferred occasionally inefficient government to a tyrannical one. Article 1 of the Constitution addresses the power of the federal government to make laws. That article states in categorical terms, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives." That language is a grant of power to the legislature, but also a limitation on the other branches. They do not have the authority to act as a legislature and make new law, either under the guise of executing it or construing the law. The framers were cautious in empowering any part of the national government to exercise governmental authority, and they consciously made it difficult for Congress to enact new laws. They specified that a bill must pass each chamber of the two-house Congress, ensuring that it would have the support of the large states, which had proportional representation in the House, and the small states, which had equal representation in the Senate. And they also gave the President, whose powers are described in Article 2, the power to veto legislation, reserving in Congress the power to override presidential vetoes through a two-thirds concurrence. The framers, however, did not stop at imposing those now familiar procedural checks and balances on the legislative process. They also specified in Article 1 those areas in which Congress may legislate and those where it may not. They thought carefully about what powers should rest with the national government and what powers should remain with the states. They specified, for example, that Congress may regulate commerce between the states, but may not impose a tax or duty on items exported from a state. And while the framers gave Congress important but limited powers and preserved to the states, who are closer to the people, most of their traditional authority, the framers also made clear that in some areas, Congress had exclusive power. For example, the states cannot enter into treaties or coin money. And the framers placed some matters, such as granting titles of nobility, off limits to Congress and the states alike. In a radical departure from the English model of government, the framers specified in the incompatibility clause of Article 1, Section 7, that no one who holds office under the United States can be a member of either house. The opposite, of course, holds true in a parliamentary system. Those holding office in the executive begin by being members of the legislative branch. In the United States, the separation of powers was to be not only theoretical, but practical and concrete as well. Now, while Article 1 of the Constitution addresses the power of Congress to make laws, Article 2 addresses the executive power, the power to administer and enforce the laws. Article 2, again, states quite categorically that the executive power shall be vested in a President of the United States of America. Article 2 goes on to specify the powers of the President, including his familiar role as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, and his power, with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties and appoint civil and military officers. Once again, the checks and balances of divided powers and the interdependence of the separate branches are manifest in the framers' design. For example, Article 2 instructs the President to give Congress periodic reports on the State of the Union and directs the President to take care that the laws enacted by Congress are faithfully executed. Now, many scholars are surprised that the framers succeeded in establishing a single-member executive in the Constitution with significant authority so soon after cataloging the abuses of a powerful executive in the Declaration of Independence. I think the answer to that conundrum really has two parts. The framers recognized the need for a powerful executive as a check on legislative power in a system of separated powers. And second, everyone knew who the chief executive was going to be. George Washington, of course, was presiding over the Constitutional Convention. And I think the convention may have given us quite a different presidency if the framers had not had complete confidence in how Washington would execute his powers that were to come. Article 3 of the Constitution, my favorite, addresses the power of courts to interpret the laws that Congress enacts and the President administers. Article 3 states that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. A brief word about the relative stature of the branches at the time of the framing. The first government building erected in the new capital of Washington was the White House for the head of the executive branch. The second building that was commenced was the Grand Capitol, for the legislative branch. The third building was the Patent Office. The third branch of government, the Supreme Court, was forgotten and relegated to a basement room in the Capitol. In fact, it was not until 1935 that the court had a building of its own. And that, I think, is quite revealing. There is no doubt that the court had a critical role to play in the constitutional framework, but there is also no doubt that that role was regarded as a limited one. Though it met in the basement of the Capitol, the new judicial branch had independence from the other branches. Article 3 provides that the justices shall hold their offices during good behavior and that their salaries shall not be diminished during their time of service. Alexander Hamilton explained why in another of his Federalist Essays, number 78. He put it this way: "The complete independence of the courts of justice is peculiarly essential in a limited constitution. By a limited constitution, I understand one which contains certain specified exceptions to the legislative authority, such, for instance, as that it shall pass no bills of attainder, no ex post facto laws, and the like. Limitations of this kind can be preserved in practice no other way than through the medium of courts of justice, whose duty it must be to declare all acts contrary to the manifest tenor of the Constitution void. Without this, all the reservations of particular rights or privileges would amount to nothing." End quote. Hamilton had it exactly right. Many constitutions adopted throughout history have contained grand words, including, for example, as President Reagan liked to point out, the Constitution of the former Soviet Union. But without an independent judiciary to enforce those grand words against the government as well as the governed, the grand words become empty promises and a cruel joke. Hamilton's insight was given concrete expression in Chief Justice John Marshall's opinion in Marbury versus Madison. The fundamental question in that case was whether the court has the authority to review legislation to ensure that it was consistent with the Constitution. Marshall explained that our Constitution was not simply a political document, as many are, but was also law, and as law, it had to be interpreted and applied by the courts. As he famously put it in his opinion, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. His logic was simple and straightforward. Courts have the obligation of deciding cases. To decide cases, they have to say what the law is. The Constitution is law, and therefore it is the job of the judiciary to say what the Constitution means. That understanding reflects a grant of authority to the courts, but also a critical limitation, just as the other branches are given authority subject to limitation. The judicial branch has the authority to interpret the Constitution because it is law, and must be independent to do so without fear or favor. But the judges must limit themselves to that task. They may not use their independence to write their own policy preferences into the Constitution. The independence that Hamilton described is not the freedom of a judge to do whatever he pleases. Judicial independence means deciding disputes impartially by faithfully applying the law to the facts at hand. That is, by exercising legal judgment free from passion or prejudice. The framers gave federal judges life tenure, insulating them from political pressures, precisely because judges are not supposed to be making political decisions. Rather, they are to decide discrete controversies according to the rule of law. As Hamilton put it, judges exercise neither force nor will. Instead, they exercise only judgment. Now, I think an appreciation of the history of the framing of the Constitution confirms that the judicial branch was intended to be restricted to interpreting the Constitution and laws rather than making policy on their own. As I've noted, the convention that drafted the Constitution was chaired by George Washington. Many of the delegates to the convention had risked their lives to win the right to govern themselves. It is inconceivable that within less than a decade after achieving that objective, the framers would then take the politically insulated and unaccountable branch, the judiciary, and give to that branch the authority to decide whatever difficult questions of policy might arise. The exercise of independent judgment by judges sometimes requires, in the words of President Reagan, the lonely courage of a patriot. Judges must have the courage to make unpopular decisions. That is the sole reason they enjoy the privilege of life tenure, to better enable them to fulfill the framers' vision of a society governed by the rule of law. I think the nature of the Supreme Court's jurisdiction helps the court to properly interpret the Constitution as law and avoid intruding on the political prerogatives of the other branches. The framers wisely provided in Article III, in an often overlooked provision, that there should be one Supreme Court. We may take that for granted, but it is certainly not the case everywhere else in the world. Many countries have separate constitutional courts to decide constitutional questions, while other courts consider more mundane matters. The court on which I sit has the final responsibility not only in lofty constitutional cases, but also in more picayune disputes in areas such as tax and bankruptcy law, antitrust and commercial regulation, pension rules and administrative law. The fact that we routinely act as a court interpreting law across this wide range of subjects helps us get in the habit of doing so in a way that hopefully carries over to the constitutional cases as well. A constitutional court that considers only constitutional cases may be too susceptible to functioning as a political actor rather than a court of law. The framers' great innovation, an independent judiciary with the final say on what the Constitution means in a matter that binds the government as well as the governed, has withstood the test of time. It is even being embraced by the mother country. Now, as a matter of theory, the judiciary in Great Britain is not separate from Parliament, the legislative branch. The High Court there consists of the Law Lords, a committee of the House of Lords. Now, the Law Lords in practice have long had significant independence from their legislative duties and pressures. The Constitutional Reform Act of 2005, however, makes that practice the law by providing for a new Supreme Court of England and Wales, separate from Parliament. The new court will even have a building of its own. I'm sure that our founders would have been pleased to find out that the very ideals that they fought Great Britain to secure are now being adopted in that country. The framers appreciated that they were drafting a charter of government to endure into the future. The preamble, after all, spells out the purpose of securing the blessings of liberty not only for themselves, but for their posterity. And the Constitution specifically contemplates the addition of new states. These provisions have to be understood as a guide to interpreting the Constitution. For example, the authority Congress is given to regulate commerce certainly includes the authority to regulate air transportation, even though it was not familiar to the framers. The authority to provide for an army and a navy certainly includes the authority to provide for an air force, again, even though the framers probably never contemplated such an entity. What is necessary and proper to carry out responsibilities under the Constitution cannot be limited to the means that were available at the time of the framing. All of this, though, does not mean that the Constitution simply changes with the times. If it did so, it would not be worthy of the title of a Constitution. This is clear from the amendment process that the framers provided. That is set forth in Article 5, and the framers there made certain that the process would be a deliberate one and a difficult one. An amendment requires approval of 2/3 majority of both houses of Congress and the approval of 3/4 of the state legislatures. The National Constitution Center says that more than 11,000 amendments have been proposed in Congress, but only 33 have been sent to the states for ratification, and our Constitution has been amended only 27 times. By providing an express amendment process, and by making it particularly difficult, it is clear that the framers did not contemplate that the judicial branch would change the meaning of the Constitution with the prevailing tenor of the times. Now, last month, President and Mrs. Samuelson spoke about the history of the creation of the Constitution in their talk, and it is surely true that the whole of the Constitution is written against the backdrop of the American experience. But I think this is particularly true when you look at the constitutional amendments. The first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, grew directly out of the injustices suffered by the colonists under British rule. They respond to the deprivations that the colonists found most objectionable. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, outlawing slavery, guaranteeing equal protection of the laws, and extending suffrage to former slaves, are, of course, the product of our Civil War. It took that bloody conflict to resolve the one great challenge that the framers of the Constitution dodged. The 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote, arose from the long struggle for women's suffrage. And the 24th Amendment, effectively outlawing poll taxes, is a product of the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. The study of history will surely add to your understanding of the Constitution. But it will do more than simply explain the genesis of the various amendments. As Judge Robert Bork has said, the study of history, accurate objective history, frees us from a falsely imagined past. The more we know about the ideas reflected in our Constitution, how they actually took root, the better we understand those ideas and their relevance today. In studying the history of the Constitution, I think you will come away with a profound respect for those who created our nation. With a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, in the words of the Declaration of Independence, they had mutually pledged to each other their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor in the cause of independence. They then crafted the Constitution as the culmination of that pledge. The framers set a profound example for all of us about the importance of public service as part of our lives. They came from all walks of life, but they shared a common commitment to civic virtue. I think James Madison deserves particular note in this respect. Perhaps most often remembered as the fourth president, but that service was only a small part of his public life. Madison, although only 36 years old at the time of the Philadelphia Convention, is also aptly remembered as the father of the Constitution. As Rex Lee put it, Madison, quote, was not trained in any particular profession, but he was widely read and capable of clear and independent thought, remarkably unburdened by prevailing assumptions. Now, Madison not only participated in the drafting of the Constitution, but he also co-authored, with Alexander Hamilton and the Supreme Court's first Chief Justice, John Jay, the Federalist Papers, that collection of thoughtful essays urging the ratification of the Constitution. If you're looking for a book on the Constitution to read, the Federalist Papers is a good place to start. In addition, Madison's extensive notes on the convention provide us with the best record of the framers' work. Madison lived to the age of 85, was the last survivor of the Constitutional Convention. He remarked late in his life that having outlived so many of my contemporaries, I ought not to forget that I may be thought to have outlived myself. But Madison was far too humble. He left a legacy of service to his nation that continues to affect our lives to this day. Now, if you're looking for a modern example of a person who incorporated public service into a full life, I think you might well look to a renowned Utahan, one I've already cited more than once, Rex Lee. He successfully balanced family life and participation in his church and community with a demanding career that spanned the private sector, academia, and government. Rex was well known in Washington for approaching every challenge with infectious optimism and dogged endurance. I was a victim of those qualities when I argued a case in the Supreme Court against Rex. I knew the case was a difficult one and had told the client so. But I approached the case with the same sort of optimism that I thought Rex would. I forgot that Rex was on the other side. It was immediately clear that the bench was skeptical about my arguments, and the court eventually ruled against me 9-0. The hard part when something like that happens is calling the client to advise him of the news. I did that. I told him we had lost. The client said, well, what was the vote? I said it was 9-0. The client was surprised at that news. He said, 9-0? 9-0. Why did we lose 9-0? I said, well, because there are only 9 justices. I nevertheless continue to believe in Rex Lee's optimism, especially in the cause of public service. It is the optimism of the framers of our Constitution who undertook to make a nation from 13 quarreling states. It is the optimism of Brigham Young and the Utah pioneers who crossed the mountains to settle in a desert and make it bloom. And it is the optimism that each of you inherits in doing your part to create a more perfect union and to secure the blessings of liberty for yourselves and your posterity. Thank you all very much.